It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome to Andy Staples on Three. Drips, drabs, we get a little bit of clarity on the John Calipari situation, but not complete clarity. It's coming, though. It's coming. The transfer portal is heating up, not just in basketball, but in football, where it's not even open yet. We're getting the preliminary, hey, I'm going to the portal. It doesn't open until Monday, but I'm going to be in it. We're getting that. We'll talk about that. And also, some news out of Tallahassee, where Florida State and the ACC were in court on Tuesday, and a very, very interesting ruling coming down that definitely muddies the waters, as if they weren't already muddy enough. We'll talk about all of that, but first, let's talk Coach Cal. Matthew says, good morning from Lexington, Kentucky. Well, Cal was in Lexington, Kentucky, I think. Pretty sure that's which house he filmed this in. But he was basically telling everyone that he does not plan to be in Lexington, Kentucky forever. He is leaving. Did not say where. Strategically wearing the blue Nike shirt, not Arkansas colors. But he did confirm that he will no longer be Kentucky's coach. So let's hear a little bit from Coach Cal.
Since our season ended, Ellen and I have spent a lot of time thinking about our time here at Kentucky. What it means to us, the friends we've made. On that court, regional championships, conference championships, Final Fours, the national title in 2012. It's been a beautiful time for us. This is a dream job. It was my dream job. Anybody in our profession looks at the University of Kentucky in basketball and said, that is the bluest of blue. The last few weeks, we've come to realize that this program probably needs to hear another voice, that the university as a whole has to have another voice giving guidance about this program that they hear. And the fans need to hear another voice. We've loved it here, but we think it's time for us to step away and step away completely from the program. There have been opportunities that have been presented to us, and we're discussing them as a family. I love coaching. I love coaching young people. I love this year's team. I loved every day walking in. They've invigorated me. I love the chase for championships. I love bringing the kids together. It's what I do. It's who I am. Let me start, though. I've got to thank the players and the families that I've had the privilege of coaching because they've entrusted me with their son and their son's career. What they've done in the classroom, over 30 of the guys have graduated, 6 in 3 years. What they've done in this community to give back to the state of Kentucky. They gave all of us everything they had on the basketball court and off the basketball court. And I am indebted forever until the wheels fall off. And I think they all know that. I'm not going to bring.
So that is Cal. And he goes on and he talks a little bit more about how the program needs another voice. And he's right about that. He's definitely right about that. It became very clear. And it's interesting seeing some of the reporting coming out of Kentucky and also coming out of the college basketball coaching circles, where it seems like Cal was a little bit surprised that the fan base turned on him the way it did. And you know, it's interesting because the last day or so, and maybe this is why this has been rolled out this way, where you notice there was nothing about Arkansas yesterday. I suspect that'll be today. We probably get him calling the Hogs sometime today. But yesterday was about goodbye to Lexington, thank you to Kentucky. And there was a lot of kind of positive memories flowing. You know, our guys at Kentucky Sports Radio, they had an episode in the afternoon where they basically listed all their favorite memories of the Cal era. And it was really interesting. And they were having fun going back through those early days, like John Wall and Boogie Cousins and the national title with Anthony Davis and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and just all of the really great players who came through. I mean, you think about it, it's a wild number of players. You know, I just mentioned all those guys, and then you've got Karl Anthony Towns, and you got Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and you've got Tyrese Maxey, and you've got, I mean, De'Aaron Fox. Like, it is a lot of really good players. 410 and 122 record at Kentucky, 4 Final Four appearances and 1 national title for Cal. The downside of that is hasn't gotten out of the first weekend of the NCAA tournament since 2019. And that's where the problem was. That's where the disconnect happened, because Cal knew he wasn't performing up to expectations, but I don't think he realized how much that was offending the Kentucky fans who expect Kentucky to compete for championships. And you know, it's understandable, because you get into the bubble and you feel like, okay, I've done all this. There's got to be some gratitude here. I think there's gratitude, but I also think they're still paying you a lot of money to get this done. The expectations don't change. Matthew, who's in Lexington in the chat, says the vibe on campus and in town is appreciative of his time at UK, but it definitely felt like a divorce as Cal and Mrs. Cal, Ellen, broke up with UK and the fan base turned on him. He couldn't take it. That's exactly right. Exactly right. But that's to be expected. And that's kind of the life cycle of even good coaches in most cases. You don't see a lot of situations where somebody gets to go out on their own terms. What we saw with Nick Saban is a unicorn, where a guy was ultra successful, stayed ultra successful, and left before the fan base could turn. But I will tell you, and I've heard Nick Saban say this a few times to other people, but he said it to me in 2017. I was in his office. I was doing a story on Alabama. I was working for Sports Illustrated. So I was preparing, in case they ended up playing for the national title, for that national title story that runs in the magazine right after the title is won. And so you have to do all the interviews way beforehand. And so it wound up being kind of a more of a retrospective piece. And one of the things he said to me when we were talking, this was in November in his office, is I'll be gone before I let it go down. Because basically he's saying he would see any sort of cracks in the armor of his own, you know, program and how he works before anybody else did. So what he was saying what he did is he left after they lost to the eventual national champion in the national semifinal in overtime. So obviously Alabama was extremely competitive and still right there at the top of the sport. But he was saying, I don't know that I can give this anymore. I don't know that I would be able to keep this up. Cal didn't have that. Cal stopped keeping it up and everybody got mad, understandably so. Now the question for Cal is whether he can adapt at Arkansas and find a way to win in this era of college basketball. He discovered a nice formula. The NBA creates the age limit. The one and dones come in. He loaded up on one and dones. There was no NIL. There was no open transferring at first. And that allowed him to create some dominant teams. And then other coaches adjusted. For example, Mike Krzyzewski saw what Cal was doing, adapted, and started doing it as good or better than Cal. That became a problem. Then the game changed. Then teams like the UConn team that you just saw win a second consecutive national title, that became the model. That's the model right now. Presumably, the model will change again as all of this fluctuates. But right now, Cal has probably a license to change if he needs to, because he'll have a blank slate at Arkansas. One of the more interesting things I thought yesterday was, you know, I played you that Cal video, but we often don't think about all the other people involved in situations like this. And so Ellen Calipari, his wife, also released a video on her Instagram. And that one I thought was even more interesting than the one her husband released. So here's Ellen Calipari.
If you think this is easy to do, you would be wrong. I knew my roommate, Coach Cal, John Calipari, would put out his own video, but I wanted to do one of my own. And I knew when he got the opportunity to coach at Kentucky, it was a huge opportunity and a huge honor. And I supported that. And, you know, I've been here along the way watching him accomplish things, working tirelessly, winning a championship, recruiting. It's just, it's endless. And it's been a great pleasure to be here. We've been here 15 years, which is very hard to believe. Megan, or Earthly, went here for a semester. She lasted that long. Brad graduated from here. And, you know, so we will have a lot of very fond memories from being in Lexington. It's been a very warm, welcoming place to be. It's been an honor to be a part of the university. And I hope we leave behind, you know, a lasting legacy in what both of us have done. I know my roommate has done tons of things for the state of Kentucky itself, as well as, you know, representing the university. And it's been a pleasure. Being a coach's wife is a different thing than being the coach. And, you know, you just have to be supportive of what they're doing. And if he feels like it's time to move on, I have to support that. And it's not easy. And we will miss a lot of things about Lexington and the University of Kentucky.
So that's Ellen Calipari. And interesting the way she puts that, you know, if he feels like he has to move on, I have to support that. And that it's tough because you put down roots, and coaching families don't get to put down roots all that often. 15 years is a long time, but it is time for a change. Everybody seems to be in agreement on that. And but it's interesting because now the question is, what happens next? I think we know what happens is he's taken the Arkansas job. We will see him call the Hogs at some point, and then he gets to work with a roster that there's nobody on it. Unbiased Brim in the chat. Cal is forced to adjust because he has a blank canvas. It may turn out to be the perfect storm for him to adjust. I'll tell you this much. We are behind him all the way here at Arkansas. Hashtag WooPigSuey. Way Weary in the chat disagrees, says Cal is not going to adjust. He's going to continue to try to win with a bunch of five-star freshmen. Well, we'll just have to see. We will just have to see what happens. I wrote it the other day. He's got to adjust. This is very similar to Jimbo Fisher moving to Texas A&M, where you go from a place where they were about to start questioning you. Well, at Kentucky, they'd already started questioning Cal, but they were questioning you to a place where they will worship you. But that worship only lasts so long. You have to deliver. And so if Cal delivers results immediately, the worship continues, everybody's happy. If Cal doesn't deliver results, and remember, the program he takes over at Arkansas is in a much better place than the program he took over from Billy Gillespie at Kentucky. Eric Musselman went to two Elite Eights in the last 3 years. Yes, this past year was not good, but it wasn't like Arkansas ran Musselman out. They didn't want him to leave for USC. They felt like they're in a pretty good place as a program. So that is just the crux of the matter here. Meanwhile, Kentucky has to find a coach. You've got Jay Wright has said, no thanks. Nate Oates definitely stayed in Alabama. Scott Drew, we hadn't heard anything from, the Baylor coach. He's one that feels like a good fit there. Feels like he would fit well with the AD, Mitch Barnhart. Feels like he would fit into the culture there. Also feels like if they're looking for someone who can create rosters that win in this era of college basketball, he's that type of guy. Billy Donovan, we heard him talk. He's the Chicago Bulls coach. He said a lot of my representatives haven't heard from them. I haven't heard from them, which until John Calipari said he wasn't going to be the coach anymore, they couldn't officially reach out to anybody. And I have history with Billy Donovan on something like this. When he was coaching at Florida, I was a Florida beat writer. And when the Magic were pursuing him, I had to, this dance went on for like a month and a half. And so unfortunately I had to ask the question of kind of at that point, like the most senior guy on the beat, and had to ask the question over and over and over again. Are you talking to the Magic? Have your representatives talked to the Magic? Blah, blah, blah. And I ended up asking the question like 40 different ways. And eventually I perfected the wording of the question so much that he couldn't wiggle out of it. And he had to just tell me something that wasn't true. And then after he took the Magic job, he wound up apologizing for that because there wasn't anything you could do at that point. He's trying to get it all figured out. And then eventually it got to a point where they still didn't have the deal done. He's still trying to decide, well, I've got to do my job at Florida until this deal gets done. And that's how it worked out. And as we learned, he didn't really want to leave because a week later he was back coaching Florida. But we'll see with Billy Donovan. He may just like coaching in the NBA better. He may not want to come back to college. But if he did, this would be the job you would think he'd want to come back for. And then you've got, I threw out Jerome Tang as a name that I would look at if I were them, especially if you try to get Scott Drew and can't. Scott Drew's former right-hand man who's already done a very good job in 2 years as a head coach at Kansas State seems like a guy who is going to be very successful. Now, if they wind up hiring Scott Drew, I'd also look for Jerome Tang to be Baylor's next head coach. But there are other coaches out there. I saw one interesting one yesterday. So Matt Jones from Kentucky Sports Radio was throwing out some names, and then some fans underneath that on Twitter were saying, what about this guy? What about this guy? Somebody threw out Tony Bennett from Virginia. I cannot imagine that. I cannot imagine Tony Bennett at Kentucky. Yes, he's really good. Yes, he's very successful. That style, the Kentucky fans would hate it. And also, he does not like to do the showmanship, salesmanship, face of the program type stuff that John Calipari was good at early on, that a Bruce Pearl is great at Auburn, that you kind of need at Kentucky. Now, Scott Drew is not the most out there in your face guy either, but he's perfectly happy to be out front and be the guy. So if I got to handicap it, I'm still thinking Scott Drew feels like the best choice here, or the maybe not the best choice, the most realistic and best choice. The one most likely to take it and the one who would succeed at it. But again, we'll see. We'll have more on this. This is going to keep going. And I keep saying it, we're going to get it. Because I just love when Arkansas hires a new coach and that new coach has to call the Hogs for the first time. Because there are people who do it enthusiastically, and then there are people who are Bobby Petrino. Like, Sam Pittman, when he got that job, that first Hog call was epic. Sam Pittman was born to call the Hogs. Bobby Petrino, now, it was a weird situation. It was a Monday night in the middle of, it was December. It was actually game week for the Falcons. He had bailed on the Falcons on the Monday of a game week, and they got the deal done, and they just did the press conference at, like, I want to say it was like 11 p.m. local time. And he's calling the Hogs, and they got everybody on stage. And he's like, the look on his face is like, what have I gotten myself into? Dana Altman. Remember that? Remember Dana Altman took the Arkansas basketball job for a day? He had to call the Hogs. That didn't work out very well because he ended up going back to Creighton. But Sam Pittman probably is the best, most natural Hog caller that we've seen in this era. Brett Bielema was a pretty good Hog caller too. But I think Cal is one of those that, especially because he's hitting the reset button here, and I think he's going to go back to be a back to being more of a guy who can deal with the donors and have that face of the program mentality. I think he'll do that at least at first. He will put some time and study and care into how he calls the Hogs. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that. So we shall see what happens with Cal and with Arkansas, but we have other things to talk about. We have got to get into the football transfer portal because it's been quiet. It's been sleepy because the portal hasn't been open. Now the grad transfers can pop in anytime, but the undergrad transfers can't jump into the portal until Monday of next week. Now it's going to be interesting. We talked about it. Pete Nakos and I have been going back and forth behind the scenes talking about, you know, what we think is going to happen. I don't think it's going to be as wild as, say, when the portal opened in December and just everybody jumps in and tries to figure out where they're going next. I do think it will be wilder than last year in the spring, because last year in the spring, the biggest name that jumped in was probably Bear Alexander from Georgia. He was a defensive tackle. He'd played, you know, a decent amount as a freshman, looked to play a bigger role as a sophomore, but not necessarily a huge starring role, an every down type of role, because Georgia's deep. So he hops in the portal. That news broke the day of Georgia's spring game, and he winds up at USC. Well, guess who said that he's going to the portal on Tuesday? That would be Bear Alexander. He told On Three's Hayes Fawcett that he is back in the portal as soon as he can be, and that he wants to go somewhere else. It is worth noting that Bear Alexander, who's from Texas, attended five different high schools. That would be Terrell, Skyline in Dallas, Ryan in Denton, Brewer in Fort Worth, and IMG Academy in Bradenton, Florida. And this will be college number three. But this is what's going to happen. Bobby Burton from our Inside Texas site reporting to expect Texas to go after Bear Alexander when he becomes available in the transfer portal. And he said that he plans to be available. That's a big blow for USC. Obviously, the multiple schools, the three colleges in 3 years, the five high schools in 4 years, glaring red flags. But that's one of those, if you're a college coach, you're going to go, I'll let the NFL people deal with that. I'm going to get this guy for 1 year, and he's a 340-pound wrecking ball, and I think we can use him. I think that's what's the schools that will go after Bear Alexander are going to tell themselves. And at USC, he was pretty good. He was pretty, his stats, not the best. 27 tackles, 6.5 tackles for loss, 1.5 sacks. But if you watched USC play, one, the defense was terrible. So there's not a lot of great talent around him. Probably should have been better, but like Anthony Lucas, who transferred from Texas A&M, did not wind up being the star that they were hoping that he would be. It was not the greatest situation, but he was a disruptive interior defensive lineman. If you put him alongside other talented defensive linemen, you got something pretty good there, which is what would have happened had he stayed at Georgia. But doesn't sound like Georgia is an option. Again, I don't think a return to Georgia is on the table. I just mentioned Texas as a possible destination. We'll see. But this is probably for a year because, again, he's a 340-pound defensive tackle. Those don't grow on trees. He's probably in the draft after this. But why not one more? It's a lot of schools. It's a lot of schools. The truth says calling USC defense terrible is an insult to terrible defenses. I don't know the truth. LSU's was probably worse. If we're being real about this, I don't know. But you're right. It was pretty bad. This is why they wiped out the entire defensive staff. Right now, they have a pretty good defensive haul in the class of 2025 in the commitment list. We'll see if that sticks. But right now, they seem to be finally going after the type of defensive talent that they're supposed to. But again, I don't know that helps them this year. So a big blow for USC because Bear Alexander would have been a very valuable player for them this year. Speaking of guys who would have been valuable for the team they played on last year in 2024, Oregon State tailback Damian Martinez plans to enter the transfer portal. He averaged 6.1 yards a carry for the Beavers last year. He was excellent, all Pac-12. He will be an impact back wherever he winds up. Now, this was interesting in the way it broke, because I don't think we've ever seen this before. This is one of those that in my business, people were texting each other and DMing each other like, did you see this? This is weird. So Pete Thamel from ESPN, as the story is coming out, tweets that Martinez was set to make $400,000 in NIL money at Oregon State this year. And that was just a strange one, because that feels like an NFL thing, like, this guy got cut and his cap hit is this. But you have to remember, what's the motivation for this sort of information getting out? Like, I don't think that information came from Martinez. My guess is that information came from someone affiliated with Oregon State's collective saying, hey, we got money here. So if you're in the portal, we could use a good running back. And we got some cash. And if you're Oregon State or the collective at Oregon State, this is information you have to get out there, because Oregon State's obviously in a very strange situation. They are in the Pac-2. They and Washington State are the only teams left from the Pac-12, and they have consolidated. We call it the two-pack. They keep a lot of the money from the Pac-12. They did a good job with the legal wrangling to make sure that they're going to get a lot of money that will help them be set up for the future, because their future is not going to be as lucrative as the schools that went to the Big Ten or went to the Big 12. So they've got to figure out what to do next. This is a tough spot, because obviously if you're Damian Martinez, you look at this, your coach Jonathan Smith left for Michigan State, your quarterback Aiden Chiles left for Michigan State, DJ Uiagalelei left for Florida State. DJ was probably not going to be Oregon State's. Like, if let's say the Pac-12 had held together, Aiden Chiles was the quarterback of the future. If Jonathan Smith were still there at his alma mater, yeah, that's probably how that would have gone. But now those two are at Michigan State. It's perfectly expected that if you're still at Oregon State, you're going to be looking and going, I could probably be at an SEC or a Big Ten program or a Big 12 program right now. And I don't even know if the money's the thing, because you're probably going to get decent money at any of those. But you may not even get as much as $400,000, but you may be put in a better position to show off what you can do. So we'll see what happens. But that is a very interesting entry to the transfer portal. Expect more of this over the next few days, where people say, okay, I'm entering the portal, I'm done here. You'll see guys not coming to practice. If the spring practice is still going on, you'll see guys not coming to practice. Maybe you see some guys not dress out for their spring games. We're going to get a little bit of a preview before Monday when it opens up, and then it starts to come in a little faster gush. I don't think, again, that it's going to be as wild as December was. I think that one's always going to be more interesting, and we'll see. I mean, this may only exist for another year or two. Again, there's a new model coming. They're going to have to change the model. But the guys want to be somewhere for spring so they can learn the scheme on their new team. This is more of a situation of, I feel like I can plug and play somewhere, or there's going to be a lot of, I didn't win a job and now I'm leaving. This is not one of those cases. Damian Martinez was the starter. So we'll see how many starters decide I can better my circumstances somewhere else. Because that is the big question, and we don't know the answer to that. We'll find out in the next few days and weeks. Speaking of the transfer portal, on the basketball side, very interesting entry on Tuesday. Robbie Avila, better known as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Nerd, Rob Wave, Steph Blurry, our favorite rec spec wearing hoopster, has entered the transfer portal. Avila starred for Indiana State this year. Remember, Indiana State callously left out of the NCAA tournament. They wound up making it to the NIT final, where they lost to Seton Hall. But after that, Sycamores coach Josh Scherz left to take the St. Louis job. lots of Indiana State players have hit the portal. Now, Robbie Avila went in there with a do not contact tag, which means don't call me, I'll call you. So the supposition here is that Robbie Avila is going to follow Josh Scherz to St. Louis. We'll see if that happens. I would imagine there's a few people who would be very interested in him. Now, the do not contact tag has not stopped anybody, because I'm sure Robbie Avila was getting contacted long before he entered the transfer portal. He's a 6'10 post guy with incredible moves, incredible court vision, passes out of double teams beautifully. He's the kind of guy everybody wants. Now, would he be successful at the highest level of college basketball? Would he be as good as he was at Indiana State? That would remain to be seen. But I imagine he'd have the opportunity if he wants it, or if he just wants to continue playing for Josh Scherz, he can go to St. Louis. We shall see. But it's spicy. It's juicy. He's in the portal too. One more piece of big news out of Tuesday, and I realize I'm just throwing news at you, but this is all stuff we got to talk about. In a Tallahassee courtroom, Judge John Cooper denied the ACC's request to stay Florida State's lawsuit against the league. So if you're following at home, that means a North Carolina judge last week denied Florida State's request to stay the ACC's lawsuit in North Carolina. And the thought there was, once that happened, that the Florida judge would say, okay, I'm going to stand down. This case will be tried up there. He did not say that. In fact, what he said was that the ACC filing the case when it did, which was a day before Florida State filed its suit, was a piece of anticipatory litigation designed to forum shop, essentially designed to say, we would like to have this case done here because it benefits us. Now, I would argue that Florida State filing in Tallahassee against the ACC, which is based in North Carolina, where we've known the ACC's in North Carolina all along. We've known that all of the organizational aspects of the ACC are in North Carolina. I would argue that Florida State filing in Tallahassee is also a bit of forum shopping, because that's how it works. Each side would like to have the best chance of winning, and Florida State certainly has the best chance of winning in Florida, whereas the ACC should have the best chance of winning in North Carolina. Maybe not, though. It all depends. I mean, let's say if the University of North Carolina were to jump in and do this, if they were to join Clemson and Florida State in suing the ACC, all of a sudden, the loyalties get a little bit torn there in the state of North Carolina. But so far, North Carolina has not done that. They have not been as aggressive about this as Florida State has, for sure, or as Clemson has. But what really is interesting about this is, so both cases will continue, which is very messy. Adding to that, we haven't even seen what the judges in the Clemson cases are going to say, because Clemson filed in the state of South Carolina and they filed first. Part of the ACC's goal in filing before Florida State was that might make sure that case was tried in North Carolina. But the ACC didn't get the jump on Clemson. Clemson beat the ACC to court, so they don't even have that chip. So you could see, theoretically, this case going, the FSU case going on in Florida and in North Carolina, and you could see the Clemson case going on in South Carolina and North Carolina. Very, very messy. The judge in the Tallahassee version of this case gave a pretty big advertisement for mediation during the trial, while being very clear, he's not saying he thinks either one side or the other is definitely going to win. He just said, guys, mediation is a thing you might want to talk about. I've said all along, this case will get settled eventually. There will be a number that everybody agrees upon. I don't know how far off that is. It's probably still a ways off, but it's going to happen, because as long as there's a non-zero chance the ACC might lose, the ACC has to settle this. There's no other choice. The worst case scenario for Florida State or for Clemson, should they lose these cases, they're stuck in the ACC till 2036. The worst case scenario for the ACC is the conference implodes, everybody leaves, and nobody gets anything. That's a much worse case scenario for the ACC than it is for Florida State or for Clemson. Other interesting things out of this hearing, I saw some people jumping on that an ACC attorney said in response to a question from the judge, if Florida State wants to get out, they can pay $140 million to get out. He's talking about the exit fee. That's not the full amount. If you wanted to do that, if you pay the exit fee and get out, according to the ACC's interpretation of this, the media rights still live with the ACC. And this was answered later in the hearing. They were saying, well, Florida State could buy those back, or the ACC could sell them to somebody else who would then continue to pay out to Florida State as per the agreement. So if you're Florida State, that's a no-go. That's a non-starter. You want your media rights with you if you leave. So the question is, how much would they have to pay for them? Obviously, if this were to go to trial and Florida State was to win, then they wouldn't have to pay anything for those media rights. They might have to pay the exit fee, but they might not. But that's far down the road. Again, I think they will come to a number, because the alternative, if the ACC were to lose, is too dire to risk. But it's going to be messy. Because right now, you have an ongoing case in Florida and an ongoing case in North Carolina between Florida State and North Carolina, or Florida State and the ACC. Meanwhile, you have an ongoing case in South Carolina involving Clemson and the ACC, and an ongoing case in North Carolina involving Clemson and the ACC. And if the judge in the South Carolina case feels like the judge in the Florida case did, that you could have dueling cases in that one too. The ACC issued a statement on Tuesday. While we respect the court's decision, we strongly disagree with its determination surrounding our request to stay in Florida, especially following the North Carolina court's decision. We are examining our options as it relates to next steps. Yeah, examine them hard, because eventually it's going to be a number. They're going to sit down with Florida State, sit down with Clemson, and they will hammer out a number. I don't know when that's going to happen, but that is the probably most likely outcome here. All right, let's go to the football field. Let's talk some actual football. Courtroom stuff, I realize it's become a big part of college sports, but not the most fun part of college sports. The fun part is talking about these teams on the field. We're going to talk about a team that won two consecutive national titles and then last year got upset in its conference title game, did not make the playoff, but could be the biggest beneficiary of the new system that starts this year. We talk, of course, of the Georgia Bulldogs. Let's talk to Jake Rowe from Dogs HQ about them Dogs as they prepare for their spring game. Joined now by Jake Rowe of Dogs HQ, Georgia. We'll have its spring game on Saturday. It's one of those everybody wants to see, because the Dogs, obviously one of the favorites to compete for the national title, as they have been pretty much every year of the Kirby Smart era. But Jake, the way things ended last year, losing in the SEC championship game, playing in an Orange Bowl against a Florida State team that didn't want to be there, that didn't have most of its players. How bad does Georgia want to get back on the field and play in a new format where, if what happened last year happens this year, they're still in the playoff and they still have a chance at the national title?
Yeah, I think they're pretty fired up about it. And I think they're really fired up about the schedule, because there's no other way to be if you want to try to win a championship. You can't sit here and bellyache about that tough schedule, which is, you know, start the season against Clemson. You got Alabama in September at Alabama. You got Texas at Texas in October. Ole Miss at Ole Miss in November. I mean, it's a very, very tough schedule. And, you know, Georgia getting Carson Beck back, all that stuff. I think that you're looking at a team that you talk to some guys. And listen, I understand Florida State was decimated and didn't want to be there. But you were talking to those guys leading up to the Orange Bowl, and losing their second game out of the past, 45 just wasn't sitting well with them. You could tell they were frustrated by that, that they wanted to be in the playoff. They weren't entertaining this should we be in the playoff stuff. But, I think most people understand that while Georgia didn't do what it took to get there, they were still probably, most would agree, one of the four best teams in the country last year. And I totally understand why they didn't get there. They didn't deserve it. They didn't do what it took to earn their way there. They had an opportunity. They didn't do it. But I think that this team has kind of had a sour taste in its mouth. And for the first time in a while, Kirby kind of gets to play the disrespect card. He kind of gets to play the, hey, you didn't do it. Hey, this team didn't accomplish anything because it didn't. And I think that's a key, motivational factor.
I always felt like Nick Saban was better in those years when he was coming off something like that. And it made the offseason easier. And then with Georgia in this particular offseason, there's a Clemson game sitting there right off the bat that gives everybody reason to be excited, reason to feel like, okay, you got to be ready right away.
Yeah, 100%. And that if you look and you kind of see when Georgia has, come out of the gates the best, it has been with kind of a big opener. It really has. And last year, everybody, was kind of saying it. I was saying it is this, the team looked a little bit bored. It looked a little bit and right or wrong. I'm not one of these guys that thinks that the team I cover, it has been for the last few years, is just this dominant team all the time and glass half full all the time. But the fact of the matter is, Georgia opened with you drew an Alabama comparison there. When Georgia opens with Oregon, Clemson, there's a lot of energy. There's a lot of fire. There's a lot of – you see an elite, effort from Georgia from the jump. And I think that's good for that football team when you combine – Clemson in the opener, plus what we talked about there with that kind of extra motivation in the offseason, I do believe that it's the recipe for a Georgia team that can start fast. Oh, and, again, you bring back a second-year starter at quarterback and a lot of veterans on this team too, especially in the trenches.
Well, and so we just showed that schedule again. At Alabama, at Texas, at Ole Miss, which before we talk about Georgia in the spring, we'll give some credit to Georgia AD Josh Brooks. I don't know how much of his fighting for this is the reason that the SEC is just flipping the 2024 and the 2025 schedules. My suspicion is they didn't want to completely redo 2025 schedules because they're going to have to redo them again for 26. But that means that the 2025 Georgia home schedule might be the greatest home schedule in the history of college football.
It's definitely one of the best in school history. That's 100% correct. I mean, and you knew you were hearing and that was going to happen. Not necessarily that it was going to get flipped, but the Georgia was going to get a pat on the back for kind of the 2024 schedule. I'm with you. I don't know how much the lobbying or anything like that had to do with it, but I tell you what, man, there are a lot of donors at Georgia and a lot of people that haven't donated over the years. They're going to be like, oh, well, I think this year I'm going to try to get those season tickets. It's going to be a tough one. It's going to be an absolute tough one. They're going to price some money out of you to get you those tickets. Not because the tickets are going to cost that much, but because those point thresholds and all that stuff, if you don't know how that works, get season tickets in college football. It's a lot of these schools have these longstanding points and fun traditions where you got to donate a certain amount. And, that one is going to be pretty special, and that 2025 schedule is looking really nice.
Well, and the other thing to consider, and this is if you're a fan of a Georgia, of an Ohio State, of an Alabama, of a Penn State, of a Oregon, the schools that we're talking about are probably going to be able to compete for the 12-team playoff every year. If you don't win your league, and winning the 16-team SEC, winning the 18-team Big 12 or Big 10 will be challenging. Like, if you don't win your league, those types of schools are probably playing a home game in the playoffs. So you got to have season tickets to get into the door of that game too.
Yeah, that's going to be wild. It's such an unknown, and I'm not a big college football playoff expansion guy. I feel like just as I was starting to kind of fall in love with four, they expanded.
Just ripped away.
Yeah, just ripped it away. I do think that the whole idea of a college football game, a playoff game, a win and you advance, a lose and you go home, being played on a college campus, I can get down with that. I really like that part of it. And that's going to be a lot of fun, man. That is going to be so much fun. And, you know, I can see a lot of situations where Sanford Stadium might get opportunities like that, because like you said, it is so incredibly challenging to go through these gauntlets of schedules. And you look at the way Georgia has scheduled in the future, you know, got a couple of home and homes with Clemson coming up over the next several years. Got a home and home with, I believe, Ohio State, Florida State. You look at, you know, those plus, you know, you start talking about playing Texas and Oklahoma on your schedule. You know, those, it's going to be hard to win the league, and, you know, you may find yourself playing an extra game. That extra game may be at home, and it may be, you know, kind of once in a lifetime experiences in a lot of instances, or at least feel that way.
So let's talk about this team that will take the field on Saturday for the spring game, but also this season. And, you know, we could talk about the new guys, but I want to ask about a guy who's been there, a fifth year guy. And I remember watching him last year in the SEC championship game. It's Arian Smith, the wide receiver, and obviously had the huge Peach Bowl against Ohio State a couple of years ago. But I looked out on the field in Atlanta when they're playing Alabama, and I see Arian Smith out there, and I'm like, wait, he's still on the team? And yes, he is. And now he's back for year five. Is this one of those situations where somebody who's kind of waited his turn, who's been through some stuff, might emerge in his last year?
Yeah, I think that's very possible. And one of the things about Arian Smith is that there are a couple things here. First, he had a hard time staying healthy for 3 years. He had a hard time staying healthy. He finally stays healthy in his fourth year, and his confidence just kind of plummets. He has some drops, has some struggles. You know, it just wasn't great. It just wasn't. And I think that, you know, one of the things that Georgia has done this year, you know, that you hear about in the program is they've made a concerted effort, and Kirby even, you know, kind of used that word. They've made an effort as a staff to just kind of pour into this guy and be like, all right, listen, you know, this is, you know, the clock's ticking for you. You've got a world of ability. You're finally healthy. Let's pour into you. Let's get you ready. Let's show that we've got confidence in you, even if you may be struggling confidence on your own. I think that's been big for him this spring. Also think bringing on James Coley. Listen, James Coley doesn't have a ton of experience coaching wide receivers. It hasn't really been his primary position over the years, even though he's coached a lot of them. I think he's coached tight ends, running backs, quarterbacks, and receivers. But his personality is great for what they really want to do and bring out of Arian Smith, because James Coley is a positive, rah-rah in the best way, you know, kind of gas you guys up a little bit. He brings a lot of confidence to the table. And, you know, one thing I'll say about this is he has had a fantastic spring on the practice field and in the scrimmages. Fantastic. There have been guys in the past, Matt Landers, who went on to Arkansas, Justin Robinson, who went to Mississippi State, who did things on the practice field, and it never really translated to the football field. This spring is the first time ever in Arian Smith's career, and I think injuries have had a little bit to do with that, and availability, first time I've ever heard a single peep about Arian Smith on the practice field. And it has been a fantastic spring for him, and he's made a lot of strides in it. You know, the funny thing is, Andy, and I don't want to get too inside baseball here, but it started in those first few practices, and you could kind of see it. We'd go out there for a media viewing period, and they would be, you know, Georgia would be running some sort of drill where they've got the receivers blocking on the edge, and this guy's just selling out. Like, it was obvious that it was like he was in, you know, fight mode, like, right away. Mm-hmm. And I really think that there's a very good chance that Georgia has maybe pushed the right buttons here and gotten him going. Now, does that mean he's going to be the leading receiver? I would not bet on that. Georgia's got Ra-Ra Thomas, and Colby Young's had a great spring. Dominic Lovett's had a fantastic spring. They bring back a lot of receivers. Dylan Bell, maybe the best receiver they've got. But Arian Smith, I think, is in for probably, you know, is on a trajectory to probably have his best season yet at Georgia.
Well, and that's the question, is with Ladd McConkey and Brock Bowers headed to the NFL, who is Carson Beck targeting the most, do you think, when we get now? Obviously, spring game may be a little bit different because you'd be trying to work some different guys. But when it comes to that Clemson game, who do you think Carson Beck is going to be looking to throw to?
Dom Lovett is the guy. And you know, it's funny, you know, you've heard a lot of Arian Smith buzz, big plays in scrimmages, big plays in practice. You've heard a lot of Colby Young. Man, this guy's a transformer. I mean, there's somebody inside him driving him, because that's how big and freakish he is. and he's made a lot of plays. And you've heard some, even some murmurs about, oh, well, you know, Colby Young was best player on the field today. Dominic Lovett has been a steady thread throughout this entire spring for Georgia. He was Georgia's second leading receiver last year. And if you go back and look, I thought this was really interesting. I did it here recently. If you go back and look at the games where Brock Bowers came out early, missed significant time, or missed games, Lovett was fantastic. I think it was something around 5 to 6 catches for on average for about 60 yards a game. And, you know, that's something, you know, you push that over the course of a, you know, 13, 14, 15 game season, you're looking at an 800-900 yard receiver. And that was in year one with a new quarterback that he had never played with. He wasn't the first option. Brock Bowers was the first guy out there. And then he wasn't even the second option when Ladd McConkey got healthy. So you're talking to, in my opinion, you're talking about a guy who you've got a big, strong arm quarterback that likes to throw the ball over the middle of the field. You got a really talented veteran slot receiver with all the, you know, ability in the world. I would say Dominic Lovett is probably going to be Georgia's go-to guy.
Well, and that's – it feels like they've got plenty of options because obviously Oscar Delp comes in at tight end, a little different look than Brock Bowers, but that he's got plenty of experience. I want to go to the other side of the ball, to the defense. Tell me a little bit about C.J. Allen and what he's done this spring at linebacker.
You know, C.J. Allen, you didn't hear much about him to begin with, and C.J. kind of looks like, if you just watch him, right, if you just say, all right, I've got my eyes on, he was number 33 last year, he's number 3 this year, you see a guy that almost looks a little bit like an old school linebacker because he seems to be carrying about 230, 235 pounds. He's kind of looks like a downhill thumper, but he's a fantastic athlete, played running back in high school, he's really good. I think he kind of struggled adjusting to some of the nuances of the position last year. And you saw some bad run fits. Like you go back to that Tennessee game when they broke the 75-yard run the first play of the game. I mean, he runs himself completely out of the play. Well, he's gained a lot of confidence over this spring as a run defender. But he's also a very, very good pass defender. And that's something that's really started to kind of come out with him, especially in these scrimmage settings.
Well, and I feel like teams are kind of going back to that. You know, Alabama has Deontay Lawson, who's a similarly built kind of linebacker. And it feels like you kind of have to do that because teams have gone a little heavier in the run game as the game has evolved. Defense has got really light. So offense has started to get heavier again. And it feels like Georgia's ready to be prepared for that.
Yeah. And funny thing is I was talking to somebody about this the other day. Offenses, I feel like, have gotten a lot more creative in terms of against defenses like the ones Georgia plays, where Georgia likes to cover up all the offensive linemen, let the linebackers run free. And a lot of these run scheme things have been designed around, okay, let's get a lineman free so that we can get a body on a guy at the second level. And then, you know, all of a sudden you're trying to kind of counter that as a defense. You've got to have a somebody that can step up and snap a guard's head back and make a play. And I think that's something that Georgia's dealing with there. And I expect Georgia to be, listen, Georgia took a step back, and this really speaks to how good Georgia was up front in 2021 and 2022. But Georgia took a step back on the defensive line last year and probably still had a top 5 to 8 off defensive line in the country. Sorry, they took a step back on the defensive line and had a top 5 to 8 defensive line in the country. I think they're going to be better this year than they were last because you got Jeremiah Hall, a former 5-star prospect. You've got Christian Miller. All of these guys are going into their second years being major contributors. Also, Georgia brings back a couple of fifth-year guys who, you know, played significant roles on a couple of national championship teams. And I think that front seven for Georgia, especially when you factor in you guys like Michael Williams and Tyron Ingram Dawkins, Gabe Harris, all of the depth and linebacker, and they're going at it without Smile Munden, an inside linebacker, because he's dinged up this spring. That Georgia front seven, I feel like, just in general, is going to be kind of back on par to what Georgia's, you know, considering to be its standard there, and at least a little bit closer to what it was last year when they were so dinged up and so young.
So one thing it feels like we've seen in the NIL and portal era is schools like Georgia, Ohio State, Alabama, it's harder to keep the depth that they used to have. That used to be the kind of the prohibitive advantage that they had. And you saw Florida State kind of raid the cupboard when it came to Alabama and Georgia this offseason, where they're pulling starters from guys that were going to be competing for spots at Georgia and Alabama. So for Georgia, how deep are they relative to those teams in 18, 19, 21, 22, you know, where they felt like they were the deepest team in college football?
Well, it's marginal, but it's still important. And I don't know if that's almost like oxymoronic to say that, but it's, you're talking about a player or two, and that can mean a lot. You know, it really, now your depth is younger than it's ever been, because you're, and a lot of times you talk about, all right, well, you got four defensive tackles or, you know, five defensive tackles, you know, your fifth or sixth guy that's going to play 10 to 12 snaps a game for you is going to be a freshman, redshirt freshman type. That's just the way it is. You don't, Alabama built such a juggernaut off the back of having guys like Quinnen Williams stick around and bide their time for 2 years and then explode in year three. You know, that was one of the things that made them so great, is they were able to stockpile that. Quinnen Williams isn't waiting around for 3 years in today's college football. He's just not going to do it. He's going to go somewhere and play some ball and get drafted high. So, you know, I think that what you're seeing from Georgia, they brought in a big D-line class this past year, you know, speaking to that position specifically, they're not going to be as deep and as experienced as they were, especially in 2021. 2021 was just a unicorn type of, I mean, that team had four first round defensive linemen on it. I don't know if we'll ever see that again unless they get the portal stuff reined in completely and start getting these, you know, start paying these guys and getting them on 2 or 3 year contracts or whatever. I just don't think you're going to see it again, especially when you're looking at, you know, all the experience there. I mean, the four guys, first round, two drafts, that's kind of what it broke down to be. And that is going to be extremely difficult to do now.
This was a big line of scrimmage recruiting class. Mm-hmm. Who among those freshmen do you think might get to see the field? Obviously, it's Georgia, so it's a little bit harder to get on the field as a freshman, but who this spring has shown signs that they might be able to pull it off?
Offensively, you got Daniel Calhoun, who's working at guard. And you know, I say that, and I'll preface it by saying this. There's talk out of Georgia, out of the building there at Georgia, that this is the best interior group of offensive linemen that Kirby Smart has had since he's been at Georgia. They're really good at tackle too, but you know, if you look back at kind of some, even the best teams, they've kind of had a really good guard or a really good pair of guards, and then they were trying to figure it out at center, or they had a really good guard in the center, and the other guard spot was maybe not necessarily a weak link in a you know, pejorative or a negative sense, but a weak link because there's got to be one, and he's probably the guy. Well, now with Micah Morris, Dylan Fairchild, Tate Ratledge, they feel like they are set at guard, and they're really excited about Jerry Wilson at center. But to put all that together, Daniel Calhoun, with all of that going on, has still been able to generate some buzz. It's kind of getting some second team work. Mammoth human being, 6'6". He reported like 370 pounds. He's already into the 330s, 340s. I know Georgia feels really good about those offensive linemen they took, because so many of them needed to come to campus and drop weight, and all of them did. And that was very important. You think if you're Stacy Searles, you're thinking, maybe I recruited the right type of guy for them to come in and do that. But then you look over to the defensive side of the ball, that's always tougher. I feel like defensively, the closer you are to the football, Rusty Mansell and I have talked about this many times, the closer you are to football, the harder it is to make an impact on day one. But Joseph Jonah Ajanye, he's gotten a lot of reps this spring because Ty Ingram Dawkins has been out with a foot injury, and Michael Williams moved to outside linebacker. So you're talking about a freshman who on the hoof looks the part, 6'4", you know, 270 pounds, 275 pounds is everything you want, but he doesn't even turn 18 until November. So he is a young guy. You know, he's going to play his first college game at 17 years old, but there's a lot of excitement about him. And I would say he probably has the best chance based on position, because he plays D end and not nose or defensive tackle, but you know, the position and just raw talent, he's got a chance to help him right away.
So you mentioned Tate Ratledge in that group of interior offensive linemen. Tate Ratledge, fellow podcaster, host of the Real Talk podcast. It was a good show when he and Rylan Godey started it. It was a pretty good show last year when Zion Logue, the D lineman, took over for Rylan after he transferred to Mississippi State. The new co-host, though, Brett Thorson, Yeah. Australian punter. I'm worried. I'm worried that these guys are just going to blow us off the map.
Yeah, I am too, man. I am too. Like, I listen, they've you much so less than me. All right. Like, you tasted it. Like, you got a chance to play a little college ball and get yelled at by a college coach and stuff like that. This is, we need these guys to stay out of this. I'm much more worried about these guys than I am AI. That is 100% fact. Like, I mean, Brett Thorson gets a chance to play college football in front of hundreds of thousands of fans, and he's going to be funnier, more engaging, and better at this than I am.
An Australian, the accent's a killer.
Yeah, that's not even fair, man. It just it doesn't work out right. I mean, we need these guys to understand that. Just leave some for the rest of us, okay? Just yeah. let us have a little bit too. We all need to survive in this world.
All kidding aside, if you haven't listened to Real Talk, it's hilarious, and they take you very deep inside the game. It's funny because I remember talking to Tate a couple years ago about it, and he said, "Oh, you know, Kirby Smart's a pretty tough editor." So you wonder what doesn't make the show, but it feels like they get you inside of Georgia practices, inside of those games, and it's a lot of fun. So we'll have to have them on to regale us with some stories in the off season. But yeah, adding the Australian part of the mix is just not fair.
It's not. But I'll say this about the Kirby Smart being a tough editor part. I ran into someone here recently that told me about spending a couple of days with Kirby Smart, and I don't know that they're going to have to go to a 30-hour day before the man's got time to edit a podcast. I do know that.
Exactly.
I don't know that. I think Kirby may have a editor by proxy on that whole thing, but I don't think that they can blame any sort of – can't let those guys use excuses and blame Kirby for any show that's lacking in entertainment, because I don't think the visored ninth-year head coach has a whole lot of time to get comb back through. Heck, I don't even have the attention span to comb back through the podcast.
Not in this day and age. Not in this day and age. Kirby Smart has a lot on his plate. And I guess the last question, because with Georgia – last year, Bear Alexander was kind of the big name that entered the transfer portal in the spring window throughout the country. Like, he was probably the biggest name in the country that entered the spring transfer portal window. Any worries that Georgia might have some guys popping in after this over anything other than playing time? Because I think if it's playing time, there's really not much you can do about it at this point.
Man, this is – yes. And I'm not – I don't know. I can honestly tell you I have not heard of one guy, not one specific guy that you would have to be worried about that with, but that's what we're dealing with now, right? That's where you're at. Is it's one of those situations where law of averages, you call it what you want, just kind of leading the dove, you know, whatever you got to say here. It's one of those things. It's kind of like, do I know of anything specific on the horizon at this point? No. Is it likely to happen? Yeah. There is likely something to happen there. And it's just because that's the way it is. And you know, almost everybody, you look in the two windows, almost everybody's going to lose somebody they don't want to lose. And that's the way this goes now. And, you know, I don't even call it tampering. I just don't know that there's a better word for it. It's what has to happen. You know,
it's the only way it actually works, because the timing of it is so compressed that, yeah, everybody knows. Like, every personnel guy knows.
Kirby mentioned it, I think, during bowl interviews or something like that. He said, in my experience, guys don't transfer unless they know where they're going. And so it's kind of one of those deals that everybody has to kind of figure it out and you know, get a head start on it. So with all of that going on, you know, the whole negotiation process starts taking place before the portal window even opens. And then, you know, ultimately – you can think you've got a guy back in the fold 5, 6, 7, a dozen times. And next thing you know, he's showing up in your office saying that somebody gave him a better deal. And that's, you know, that it's the Wild West. On one hand, I can understand how I'm not built for it. And I would say, you know, to hell with this and I'm done and kind of throw my hands up and just let the guy go. That's one of the reasons I'm not making a lot of money doing this, though, because these guys they keep at it. They're really competitive, and I think
What Georgia does better than most is they value retention. They know who they want to keep. Like a couple years ago, Amarius Mims. That's a guy you want to keep.
Yeah.
And they made sure they kept him. That really is the name of the game. So it feels like they figured that part out and aren't willing to overextend on the freshman, that sort of thing. So it'll be an interesting week or so because you can kind of tell who values who when all this stuff is going on.
100%. And listen, I expect Georgia to be active in trying to add. We were having a discussion on the Georgia show the other day, and Rusty made the comment, hey, if a guy goes in, we were talking about quarterbacks. If a quarterback goes in that they feel like can help them, we fully expect Georgia to be in the transfer portal market. We've said that for months. I definitely think the odds are high that Georgia's going to add a quarterback because they like having four quarterbacks in that room if they can find a guy that they like enough and is willing enough, willing to come. But that's – you could say that about every position since Kirby Smart's been at Georgia. They have gone out and gotten grad transfers before we had the one-time transfer rule to help them right away. Did it with Maurice Smith and Jay Hayes from Notre Dame. They've done it since the portal's open, and I expect Georgia to be in the market for quarterback, maybe D-line, in this 15-day window, and they're going to be at it. And listen, Georgia's got to lose some guys to the portal because once the rest of this 2024 class shows up, Andy, I think they're at 88 scholarships. So they got to chew some down anyway, and if they want to add some more via the portal, they got to lose even more than that.
That's right. If you haven't won a job yet by the spring game, maybe time to look elsewhere. Jake Rowe, thank you so much.
Anytime, bud.
That is Jake Rowe. So there will be action to and from Athens in the spring transfer portal window. There will also be action on this show tomorrow. It's going to be a particularly epic edition of Dear Andy. We've been doing the guest ones lately. Very special guest. The newest addition on three, Steve Wiltfong, Vice President of Recruiting and Transfer Portal. Perhaps the greatest recruiting reporter of all time. You have a chance to pick the brain of a guy who has seen it all in the 21st century in recruiting. So get those questions in. You know where to find me. Andy_Staples on Twitter, on Instagram. AndyStaplesOn3@gmail.com. This is quite a resource we have at our disposal. It's going to be so much fun. I have questions for Steve Wiltfong. I know you do too. Can't wait. Get those questions in at Andy_Staples on social media, AndyStaplesOn3@gmail.com. We'll be back tomorrow with some Fong bombs.